Who filmed you out there? Ren said.
I don't know.
Did he film you, the killer? Did Bob make this film?
I doubt it, I said. Not his style.
I would have thought it was exactly his style, Ren said.
I Shazammed it, that song. It's some old music hall number. The Laughing Policeman by Charles Jolly. As if on cue, Charles Jolly stopped laughing and started singing. He said, I must arrest you. He didn't know what for. And then he started laughing until he cracked his jaw.
It's gone viral, Ren said. You see how many hits you've got?
My phone went. It was the chief super. I pictured her in one of those top-floor offices at New Scotland Yard, where they either have a view of the river or a view of the park. And I knew from the ice-cold ferocity in her voice that she was looking at neither. Detective Chief Superintendent Swire was looking at my little film. I was no longer Flavour of the Month. I was a flavour that had been discontinued.
I think you've been promoted beyond your ability and experience, she said. That day at the railway station, you were right and I was wrong. You got your medal and your pay rise and your transfer to Mallory's outfit. But here's the thing. I think nothing could have stopped you running that man down. I think that is who you are, Wolf. I think you would have run him down if he'd had a bag full of onion barges. I think because of your personal history, don't be surprised, it's all in your file, you are completely out of control. Do you know why we don't have guns, Detective?
I knew the answers off by heart. Because we don't need them, ma'am. Because we have trained firearms officers. Because the public do not want their police to be armed, and because if every officer had a firearm, then standards would slip from their current high level.
No, she said. The real reason we don't have guns is because of reckless bastards like you. In a war of smart bombs, you're an unexploded device. You're not even a loose cannon, Wolf.
She hung up, and I saw that Mallory was standing in the doorway of MIR1, holding his takeaway tea and staring at me. I couldn't look at him. Not because the world was laughing at me. Please, I have a daughter. But because the world had seen me crawl. I did not feel like going to the gym, but I knew I needed to. I knew I had to. I knew I must exhaust my body tonight. That muscle and blood and bone must be so weary by the time I got into bed that a few hours of sleep was at least a possibility. And I had to fill my head with something other than my humiliating new career as an internet sensation. There was a sign in Fred's, and as the gym emptied near closing time, I stood looking up at it. It was placed between a posed black and white photograph of Sonny Liston and a picture of a dozen Cuban kids sparring in a ring with ropes like snapped elastic. Pain is just weakness leaving the body. It was a good message. And there had been times when I'd believed in it, and it had helped me, but not today. Today I did not feel that the thick, burning knot of pain in my lower back was just weakness leaving the body. Today, pain was just pain. Fred walked in. He went over to the music system and fiddled about with it until he found some early Clash. The gym was filled with the crashing guitar chords of Mick Jones and Joe Strummer's Machine Gun Bark. Fred picked up a towel that somebody had dropped on the floor and went off to put it in the laundry. When he came back, I was leaning against the ropes and staring at the square that we call a ring. My back was stiff with pain, and I reflected on the fact that the things that hurt me the most were a source of entertainment for others. Fred and I leaned on the ropes, the sweet stink of a boxing gym all around us, the Clash at full volume, and the silence between us was not awkward. And then he spoke.
It's not about how hard you can hit, he said. It's about how hard you can get hit and then keep going for just long enough to hit the bastard's back.
Chapter 17. Let him go. On the far side of a field that glittered with early morning frost, Scout released the dog and he began tearing towards me. Hampstead Heath, early Sunday morning. The forest at the top of London.
We were in a meadow high on the heath, and my daughter and my dog seemed giddy with all the sunlight, fresh air and freedom. All around us were trees that still clung to the last of the red and gold leaves of autumn. Beyond them, you could see the city from Canary Wharf to the BT Tower. It felt like it all belonged to us. We should do this more often, I thought. We should do this all the time. The field we were in looked perfectly flat until Stan began racing across it. With him in top gear, I suddenly became aware of all the dips and bumps and rabbit holes. As he came to one sudden drop in the ground, he extended his front legs before him and his hind legs behind to dramatically bound across. He looked like he was flying. Scout shouted with delight, "Super dog!" Stan raced towards me, his large ears streaming behind him, bright eyes shining and mouth open, panting, going flat out. It was his first time off lead, and he was almost hysterical with excitement, and so were we. I got down on my knees, my back moaning in protest, and held my arms wide to greet him. Then he was on me, breathing hard and snuffling for the chicken treats I held in my fists. I fed him the treats, his nose a wet button in my palm, and I kept hold of his harness until Scout gave me the signal. And he flew back to her side. Hampstead Heath was dog heaven. Dogs of all sizes passed through this meadow on their walks, some of them coming over to give Stan an investigative sniff. Others lost in their own world of smells, uninterested in the little red squirt off lead for the first time. Dogs paced along the perimeter of the meadow where the trees began. Noses pressed to the ground on the trail of some long-gone rabbit or fox. But Scout and I stayed on the meadow with Stan running between us until he was gasping with exhaustion and our bags of chicken treats were almost empty. We were both grinning with happy relief. Stan had gone off lead and he hadn't been lost. I took out his dog lead. It was time to go home. And then he saw the birds. Two fat crows pecking the ground just beyond the tree line. And they took flight as Stan hurtled towards them. Scout and I chased after him, calling his name, but the birds had touched some ancient nerve, and suddenly he was not interested in chicken treats or us. The elm trees were old and huge on that part of the heath, and their spreading boughs formed a thick canopy that made it impossible for the birds to take to the sky. So they flew low, flapping wildly, unable to break free. And Stan went after them. Within seconds, we had lost sight of him. We staggered among the trees, calling his name, and within minutes, we too had completely lost our bearings. The heath was dense and wild up here, although we could hear the distant buzz of traffic on Hampstead Lane and could easily imagine our dog under their wheels. Scout began to cry, silently, hopelessly. I put my arm around her and called Stan's name again, though it felt useless. The traffic was closer now. There was a tight knot of fear and grief in my stomach. And then we saw them. The woman coming through the trees with a little red dog in her arms, and another dog scampering off lead by her side, a Pekingese Chihuahua cross. I recognised the dog before I recognised Natasha Buck in her flat cap, green hunter boots and black waterproofs, a city girl dressed for the country. Scout and I choked out our thanks for Stan's safe return. "Don't thank me," she said. She pointed at the Pekingese Chihuahua cross, daintily snacking on rabbit droppings by her boots. "Thanks, Susan." We thanked Susan. I clipped on Stan's lead, and we walked back to the meadow while Natasha told us how they had been walking back from Kenwood House when they came across a young Cavalier King Charles Spaniel shivering alone under the elms. Then she asked us if we wanted a cup of hot chocolate. I looked at Scout and Scout looked at me. "Yes, please," we said. We walked back to our cars with our dogs on their leads, and I thought that we looked like one of the families who take their dogs on the heath at the weekend, one of those lucky families, not perfect, but intact. At first, I thought she was moving out,
There were boxes in the hallway of Natasha's flat, some of them sealed and some of them open, piled high with clothes and sports equipment and shoe boxes overflowing with old photos, but she was only shipping out her husband's things. She brought us our hot chocolate. "First time off lead?" she asked. "Yes," Scout said. "I don't like it. Off lead is scary. I don't like it when he can just run away."
Natasha laughed. It was the first time I had seen her laugh properly, without anything behind it.
"But you have to let him go," she said. "You have to give him that freedom. He's a dog." "I know he's a dog," Scout said, "but I don't like it."
Stan roamed the perimeter of the flat, sniffing the skirting board. Susan followed him, sniffing his backside. Natasha and Scout followed the pair of them, laughing together. Some people who don't have children themselves try too hard, but Natasha wasn't like that. She was easy and friendly, and I thought I saw her for the first time, this wild girl who wanted to settle down but picked the wrong man. She looked back at me and smiled. They paused at the window, looking across Regent's Park. Natasha slipped her arm around Scout's shoulder. My daughter lifted her face to say something. I sipped my hot chocolate. Hugo Buck had owned a lot of stuff, I thought, looking at the boxes. The two paintings of the empty city were no longer on the wall. I could see them sitting alone in an old champagne box. I went over and picked one of them up. The style was very familiar to me now. The secret corners of the city, empty of people, changed by twilight. I'd seen it here. I had seen it on the wall of the Jones family home, and I had seen it again in Salman Khan's office. The abandoned city in soft half-light. London, I took it to be London, as a place of loneliness and shadows and sadness, full of the Sunday morning stillness that James Sutcliffe saw in the world. The one I picked up featured the deserted railway lines. I looked in the corner for his initials, but they were not there. Instead, there was a name I did not recognise. Edward Duncan. I stared at the unknown signature, and then I picked up the other painting, the tunnel in the soft light of dawn or twilight. J.S. James Sutcliffe. Then who was Edward Duncan? I placed the painting side by side, and I saw what I had not seen before. The style was similar, so alike that it was easy to assume they were by the same artist, but the painting by Edward Duncan was different. It was different from the painting that had J.S. in the corner. It was different from the painting on the wall of the Jones family home, and it was different from the painting on the wall of Khan's office. It was something to do with the artist's use of light. Natasha was saying something to me. The dogs were at my feet, and Scout tugged at my sleeve, but I could not tear my eyes from the painting. Edward Duncan's world was darker than the one James Sutcliffe knew. The light was not fading in his painting of an abandoned city. It was dying. Chapter 18. First thing Monday morning, I found TDC Edie Wren alone in MIR1 reading a new post from Bob the Butcher on her laptop. "If the radiance of 1,000 suns were to burst at once into the sky, that would be like the splendour of the Mighty One. Hashtag kill all pigs." A shy, unassuming fellow, isn't he? You've seen how many followers he's got now. Wren had her laptop plugged into a workstation, and on the desk screen I could see that she was logged into Holmes. Every scrap of evidence produced during the investigation, Operation Fat Boy, they were calling it, after the attack on Guy Piggy Phillips, had been entered into Holmes. Witness statements, forensic reports, crime scene photographs, autopsy records, every bit of it tagged with a number, a security level, and a priority status. Wren had Holmes open at the Action Management page, a yellow document that would allocate the day's work schedule for our team. But it was the social network site on her laptop that she was focused on. "Just sending Bob a message, telling him how much I love him," she said. "Not much chance of getting a response, I know, but if he replies, I can find his IP address in 60 seconds. I watched her sending Bob the Butcher some fan mail. "You're good at this stuff," I said, "the whole
digital thing. She shrugged with false modesty. Good enough. Do you think we've done all we can to find him? I said. Bob or the perp? I was thinking of Bob. Everyone in here talks as if they're one and the same, but you don't think so. I shrugged. It comes down to this. If Jack the Ripper was around today, would he tweet? Would the Boston Strangler be updating his single status on Facebook? I don't think so. Wren laughed. You're dead wrong. I think that's exactly what they'd be doing. Are you kidding? Jack the Ripper would have loved social media. The Boston Strangler, the Yorkshire Ripper, they would have got a big bang out of the digital community, taunting the law, puffing out their little chests, revelling in the horror. The horror. The digital world is made for sociopaths, as long as you don't get caught. Then you don't think we've done enough to find Bob? She pushed a strand of red hair from her face. Clearly not, because we haven't found him, have we? But it's not necessarily D.I. Gaines' fault, and I'm not being diplomatic. Bob's hiding behind multiple firewalls and IDS, intrusion detection systems, like a burglar alarm for computers, and Tor, the onion router, where every message is encrypted and re-encrypted multiple times through countless servers, so it will probably take more than a love letter to flush him out. Wren pushed back her chair and picked up what looked like a thick exercise book, the action book, which logs the tasks that have been done and the tasks that are yet to be done and who should do them. It was the real-world equivalent of the action management page on Holmes. Mallory still liked to have a paper record of everything. I see you're going back to Potter's Field today with a specialist search unit and taking more statements from the boys who were out running with Phillips, Wren observed. I nodded. As well as monitoring the action book, Wren was responsible for all the statements coming in, logging them into Holmes and for maintaining the integrity of the chain of evidence, the paper trail leading from the crime scene to MIR1 and all the way to court. It was a big job, and I could see that it bored the hell out of her. I indicated the laptop. Is it true what they say? I asked. Does everyone leave a digital footprint? Now, I wouldn't go that far, she said. Everybody leaves a digital shadow. We all live two lives, our physical life and our digital life, all of us. And the finest minds of my generation are currently working out how to sell you stuff you've already bought. So there's pixel tracking, page tagging, tracking codes. It's why all these ads seem to follow you around, to magically know it's you, she laughed. At its hollow heart, the internet doesn't really want anyone to be anonymous because it wants to sell you stuff. So everyone leaves a shadow? Yes. Good, I said, because there's something I want you to find. Bob the Butcher, she said, because he broke your back, because he made you the laughing stock of millions, and because he could have killed you if he wanted to. Not Bob, I said. I don't think Bob has anything to do with these murders. But the man I want to find just might. He will be somewhere in his mid-30s, name of Edward Duncan. She found herself a pen. Edward Duncan, she said, as she wrote. Do we have a date of birth? I can get you a possible one, but I don't want you to treat it like gospel. Okay. What does he do, this Edward Duncan? He paints. Houses? Cities. Should I put it in the action book? I smiled at her. She wasn't bored now. This one's off the book, I said. As the afternoon grew colder and darker, I stood on the edge of the ploughed field, watching 12 uniformed officers from the specialist search unit inching across it on their hands and knees, fingertips searching for evidence, the manual labour of police work. A photographer was standing in the middle of the field, staring at something on the ground. I walked over to him, and we both looked at a dip in the field containing a single perfect footprint. On one side of it, the photographer had placed a yellow marker with the number 1, and on the other side, a plastic ruler. He hummed to himself, as cheerful as a wedding photographer, as he began setting up his tripod, lights and ladder. Not you, is it? He grinned, nodding at the footprint. I don't think so, I said. Well, he said, adjusting his tripod, maybe it's the farmer's wife, and maybe it's our man. You never know your luck, do you? I agreed that you never knew your luck, and headed towards the woods, my back aching in protest at being forced across a ploughed field. The SSU van was parked just beyond the tree line, and another dozen officers were sitting around it gulping down tea and bars of chocolate, their clothes filthy from the fingertip search, their exhausted faces as black with sweat-streaked dirt as coal miners. I came out of the trees and onto the playing fields of Potter's Field. In the distance, the wind whipped the flag of St. George that flew above the main building. I just started towards it when I was caught by the smell of burning leaves. Smoke was drifting up from behind a tiny stone cottage at the edge of the rugby pitch. I walked round the back of it and found an old man unloading a wheelbarrow piled with dead leaves onto a small bonfire. "Excuse me, sir." I showed him my warrant card. He peered at it and nodded, then carried on with what he was doing. "Whatever you do, get their name and address," they tell you at Hendon. It's the very first thing they tell you. "May I ask your name, sir?" "I am nobody. I am just the groundsman." A strange accent that contained both Eastern Europe and the West Country. I watched him unload the wheelbarrow. There was something wrong with his hands. He glanced at me and saw that I was still waiting for an answer. "Len Zukov," he said. "Where are you from, Len?" He gave me a sharp look. "I'm from here." "How about you? Where are you from?" The accent was Russian. Maybe. "I'm from here too," I said. "Then we're both from here." "Worked here long, Len?" He was silent for a moment, as if adding it up. 30 years, he said. "Do you remember these boys?" I was holding out a photograph of the 7 boys in their combined cadet force uniforms. He shook his head. "Too quickly?" "Many boys come and go," he said. "This was taken in 1988, in your time. You don't remember them? Have a closer look. The King twins. You don't remember identical twins?" "No." The worst thing about being a policeman, people lie to you. They lie all the time. They lie because they are afraid of getting into trouble. They lie because they're afraid of getting into deeper trouble. And most of all, they lie so that you will go away. But maybe he was telling the truth. It was a long time ago, and boys had come and gone in their thousands. "But you know Mr. Phillips," I said, "the sportsmaster, and you know that someone tried to kill him." The old man looked at me as if I was some kind of idiot. "Everybody knows," he said. I watched him load more leaves on the fire and then saw what was wrong with his hands. The fingers did not open. He was building his fire with 2 fists closed by what looked like the advanced stages of rheumatoid arthritis. "It was in the woods," he said, "far from here." When the last of the leaves were on the fire, he brushed his closed fists on his trousers and we walked to the front of the cottage. There was a figure standing in the doorway, the physiotherapist Mallory and I had seen on the playing fields with the disabled men. Now I saw that he was not wearing a mask. Most of his face had been lost to burns. I held out my hand. "Sergeant Tom Monk," he said, "formerly of the Royal Green Jackets." His shockingly burned face split with a wide, white grin. He looked like a member of some lost race. I could not believe there would be a time when his face would not shock me. He clicked the heels of his ASIC trainers, and Zukov smiled for the first time. He seemed much more relaxed in the presence of Monk. "You do rehab here?" I asked Monk. "One afternoon a week," he said. "I'm mostly down the road. I'm the senior physio at Barrington Court. Or the senior physio's assistant. Yeah, that's more like it." I had heard of Barrington Court. It was a rehabilitation centre for severely wounded veterans, most of them victims of IED blasts in Afghanistan.
Mr. War lets us use the running track on Thursday afternoons, Monk said. Quite funny, really, lending us a running track when most of us don't have any legs. I automatically looked down at his faded jeans. Monk laughed. Oh, not me, he said. I've still got all my parts. Some of them are just a bit overcooked. I smiled weakly. How's he doing? Monk said, suddenly serious. Mr. Phillips. I shook my head. You know what? I really don't know, Tom. Because on the other side of the playing fields, I could see the flag of St. George being lowered and stopping when it reached half-mast. The phone in my jacket began to vibrate. I pulled it out and saw that it was PC Green and that he had already tried to call me 5 times. Peregrine War was crossing the playing fields towards me, his gown flowing behind him. But I already knew. Piggy Phillips was dead. Chapter 19. I was waiting for Ben King in the central lobby of the Palace of Westminster, the most beautiful space in London. A high vaulted octagonal hall with a giant central chandelier and an intricately tiled floor lit by natural light that pours through massive windows. The central lobby bustled with life. Constituents waited to talk to their MP. Political journalists gossiped and snickered and fawned. MPs and peers came and went from the corridors that led to their chambers, the Lords to the south, the MPs to the north. With its statues of kings and queens and a national saint over each of the 4 exits, St. George for England, St. David for Wales, St. Andrew for Scotland, St. Patrick for Northern Ireland, the central lobby felt like more than the core of Parliament, more than the place where all the corridors of power converged. It felt like the ultimate seat of British power. I watched Ben King emerge from the corridor that led to the House of Commons. He was in a group of men surrounding the Prime Minister. King saw me and peeled away from the crowd. We shook hands and walked out to the terrace pavilion, where there were white tables and chairs and people drinking tea. We stood with our backs to them all, the Palace of Westminster rising above us and the Thames flowing far below. My condolences, I said. Thank you. You were with Guy Phillips when he died? Yes. I spent the last night in his room. Did he say anything? I'm sorry, but I have to ask you. Ben King stared at the river without seeing it. It was 4 in the morning. He was sleeping. I was sleeping. I awoke because the machine that monitored his heart rate was making a different sound. I called the nurse. She was sleeping too. When she came to the room, she immediately called the doctor, but it was too late. At last he looked at me. Guy died in his sleep. I know what you're asking, but he never woke. He never said anything about who attacked him, and he passed away peacefully. And I am profoundly grateful for that small mercy, Detective. And you were with him every night he was in the hospital? Yes. Guy never married. His parents were dead. My brother and I, all of his friends, were what he had instead of family. I think he saw his killer's face, I'm certain of it. He didn't say a word. A young blonde woman was standing in the entrance to the terrace pavilion, trying to attract King's attention. He raised his hand to show that he understood, but his manners were too good to rush me. There's something else, I said. You and your brother and Mr. Khan, you're all going to be issued with Osman warnings. Osman warnings? If the police have reason to believe that someone is at risk of being murdered or seriously injured, we issue an Osman warning. It's both an official warning and an offer of police protection. King almost smiled. It sounds rather like a way of the police trying to protect themselves from future accusations of negligence. There's an element of that, I agreed. My superiors will be writing to you to offer protection and to give advice on the steps you can take to ensure your safety. Is that really necessary? Perhaps for Salman, who, I understand, is now too afraid to leave his house. But I'm surrounded by high security in the house, and Ned is out of the country and has the entire British Army watching over him. I think he's more at risk from the Taliban. We have a duty of care to warn people when they are in mortal danger,
I said. On Hugo Buck's desk, there was a photograph of seven boys at Potter's Field. You probably know the photograph.
Yes, I know it.
Now only four of you are still alive. He was watching the river again.
Three,
he said. James Sutcliffe killed himself in Italy.
Of course. My apologies.
Three of you. Then he looked at me. I want to put an end to this, he said. I want to help you in any way I can. I want to assist you in apprehending this murderer. He gripped my hand, and he held my eyes.
I know, I said. I know you do.
We walked back inside and said goodbye. As he crossed the central lobby, people approached him. Lobby journalists, other MPs, women and men, all of them with the half-smile of the truly smitten. And he had a word for each of them. But he kept walking. He never broke that long, easy stride, eventually disappearing into the northern corridor that leads to the House of Commons. And for the first time, I appreciated his true power and how much he had to lose. It's a 5-minute walk from the Palace of Westminster to New Scotland Yard, and even though I did not have an appointment in room 101, I thought it would be all right. They don't get many visitors in the Black Museum.
I saw your film, said Sergeant John Kane, the keeper of the gate.
He looked at me with his hard eyes, but there was no mockery in them.
Everybody saw your film, didn't they?
Will you watch it with me again? He was startled.
Why?
It only lasts a minute. I want to ask your advice about something. I know you've seen it already, but will you watch it with me? There was an old computer on his desk. He pressed some keys and it wheezed into life.
My one might be quicker, I said. He snorted. All mog cons at West End Central, eh?
I took out my Mac and we waited in silence as it powered up. We remained silent as I went to the social network site and found the profile page of Bob the Butcher. I began scrolling down all his postings about killing pigs and destroying worlds.
This one, I said.
I clicked on the link and there it was. The mirth with no mercy of the laughing policeman as the camera watched me crawl just as the pig appeared. I hit pause. You see that? I asked Sergeant Kane. By my right hand. He leaned closer.
A white line?
A straight white line painted on grass, I said. It's a touch line. It's the edge of a rugby field. The rugby field that's closest to the trees at Potter's Field. We stared at the image together, then he shrugged.
So what?
He said. Doesn't it prove that Bob the Butcher isn't the killer?
Why does it prove that?
That film wasn't shot when I got a good hiding.
Whatever Bob tells his devoted followers, he had nothing to do with it.
Sergeant Kane had a think, then he said,
You reckon that whoever had a knife to your throat is not the same person who stuck a camera in your face?
He can't be, can he? I said. Whoever put me down wouldn't have followed me across a ploughed field and through some woods just to shoot this funny little film, would he?
How far did you crawl?
I was running through those woods for perhaps 5 minutes. It would have taken a lot longer to crawl back. But that film wasn't taken anywhere near where I was attacked. It wasn't taken at the pig pen at the farm. It wasn't taken in the ploughed field. It was filmed when I was back at Potter's Field. It was filmed on the edge of the playing fields.
So who put it on the internet? Where did Bob get it from?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. That school has 1,000 boys, and they all have phones with cameras. There are reporters crawling all over the place. The staff? Everybody's walking around with a camera crew in their back pocket. What it proves, what I think it proves, is that Bob the Butcher is full of bullshit. Whoever took that film didn't kill anyone. And neither did he. I closed my laptop and we looked at each other. Sergeant Kane folded his heavy arms, then he nodded once.
Yes, he said. I think you're probably right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
What's the problem? The problem is they're chucking everything they've got at Bob, I said. All of our resources are being poured into looking for Bob the Butcher, serial killer of the year. Operation Fat Boy is being led up a dead end. A spasm of pain travelled up my spine, and I ground my teeth together, arching my back until it passed. "You want to find whoever messed up your back," Sergeant Kane said. "I want to find the killer." I took a breath and let it go. "And you can help me." "How can I do that?" "I want to see the From Hell letter," I said. He looked away, then looked back at me. Suddenly he was angry. "The From Hell letter? Do you know what you're asking? The From Hell letter was lost." "I don't think so," I said. "I think it's here. I think it's somewhere in this room. I think it's in your possession." "What do you know about the From Hell letter, detective?" "I know that it was also known as the Lusk letter," I replied. "It was a letter posted in 1888 by a person unknown who claimed to be Jack the Ripper." What made the police think it was the one genuine correspondence from Jack the Ripper was that it arrived with part of an internal organ from a human body. "Where do you think you are?" Sergeant Kane said, shaking his head with disbelief. "Madam Two Swords, this is a training facility for officers who put themselves in harm's way, not a freak show." "I just want to see the letter." "What makes you think it's here?" "I just don't believe it was lost. I can't believe that. The only letter from Jack the Ripper, come on. I think it would have been filed, saved, preserved." "Why lie about it?" "Don't want the public getting too excited about some unholy relic, do we? Don't need them turning a serial killer into a bigger cult hero than he is already. But I think we would have saved it."
"We?"
"The law, the Met, the good guys. And I think that if it is anywhere in London, then it will be in some secret corner of the Black Museum." He laughed.
"I suppose you might just make a detective one day. But why do you want to see it, assuming it's in my power to show it to you?"
"I want to see what the real thing looks like." He moved towards the door, and I thought he was going to call for some help and have me kicked out. But Sergeant Kane wouldn't have needed any help to kick me out. I watched him lock room 101.
"There were hundreds of letters claiming to be from Jack the Ripper," he said. "The Dear Boss letter, the Saucy Jackie postcard, the Openshaw letter. What made the From Hell letter different was that, as you say, it came with a small box containing half a human kidney."
I watched him remove a calendar from the wall that said, "Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from the Metropolitan Police." There was a safe in the wall.
"Turn away, detective," he said,
and I turned my head as he tapped some numbered keys.
"It was addressed to George Lusk, the head of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee. You can turn back now."
There was a dark green folder on his desk. He opened it. Inside the folder was a plastic envelope. Inside the envelope was a single sheet of paper, rust-coloured with age, as brittle as something scorched, like something pulled from the fire at the very last moment. Large red letters, a dozen lines, words written quickly, words written in a fever.
"Somebody slung out the kidney," Sergeant Kane said. "Sorry about that."
From Hell. Mr. Lusk. Saw. I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you. T'other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out, if you only wait a while longer. Signed, Catch Me When You Can, Mr. Lusk. It's real, isn't it? I said. You can tell. It's from him. It's from Jack the Ripper. Kane nodded. It's at a much lower literacy level than the other letters they received, but back in the day they thought that was deliberate. What's fake about it is the pretense of illiteracy. Look, he apparently can't spell to save his life, but he manages to observe the silent K in knife and the silent H in while. Unlike all the other letters, he doesn't sign it Jack the Ripper. And I'll say this for him. He did include a human kidney.
He was sick of the fakes, I said. He was tired of all the nutcases claiming credit for crimes they didn't have the skill and the madness to commit. And it's going to be the same this time. Sooner or later, the real killer will show himself. Sergeant Kane watched me staring at the letter. Bob the Butcher is not real, I said. But this is real. May I touch it? The keeper of the Black Museum stared at me. Be careful, he said. Chapter 20. One murder is a tragedy, said Detective Chief Superintendent Elizabeth Swire. Two murders are a tragic coincidence, and three murders are prime-time entertainment. The call from the Chief Super had come just as Mallory was about to start the morning briefing at West End Central. 15 minutes later, we were in a conference room on the top floor of New Scotland Yard. This high up, the brass had a picture postcard view of either St James's Park or the Thames. This room overlooked the park, but nobody noticed the view. The death of Guy Phillips had put Operation Fat Boy on all the front pages. Bob the Butcher was being called a serial killer and treated like a national celebrity. The popular press were going wild, but with a sneaking regard for Bob's dysfunctional social conscience. Bob the Butcher, feared by the rich, loved by the poor, asked the Sun. The unpopular press saw Bob as the embodiment of the seething resentments at the rotten core of our unfair society. Butcher Bob, is he a one-man riot? Pondered the Guardian, as if all Bob was doing was kicking in store windows and stealing plasma TVs. The Chief Super was not happy, and DCS Swire had a genius for registering her displeasure. She was a 50-year-old woman with a ferocious blonde haircut, hair sprayed as stiff as a Spartan helmet. Swire looked like Mrs. Thatcher's recently exhumed corpse, but with slightly less human warmth. She considered DCI Mallory with dead eyes. You initially expressed doubts that Bob the Butcher was the perpetrator, she said. That's correct, ma'am. So, have you eliminated him from your inquiries? Not yet, ma'am, Mallory said. Not yet, ma'am, she said, her tone so caustic you could have used it to strip paint. D.I. Gaines spoke up, his voice shaking just a little. He talked about anonymity networks, onion routers, and layers of encryption. Swire cut him off with a short jerk of her head. Let's skip the tech talk, shall we? She said. But tell me this. How likely is it that the average social network psycho would have security architecture that elaborate? It would be unusual, Gain answered. Swire may not have cocked a disbelieving eyebrow, but that was the impression she gave. Only unusual, she said quietly. Really? No more than that. It would be unprecedented, ma'am. Swire nodded, as if we were at last getting somewhere. What's the latest on prints? She said. Are we working the prints? Mallory's fingertips brushed his SIO policy book. He cleared his throat. The situation is unchanged, ma'am. We have no prints at any of the crime scenes. Swire stared hard at him. You mean you have smooth glove prints? No prints, ma'am. No smooth glove prints. No partials. No prints at all. The absence of prints remains unexplained. Swire let this sink in. So, he's a ghost? She said. The base of my spine pulsed with pain. He's no ghost, I said. Ma'am. She nodded, as if she had only just decided something. We're rebooting Operation Fat Boy, she said. I'm bringing in three new bodies. Swire was flanked by two men who had remained silent throughout the meeting, avoiding eye contact with the incompetent murder investigation team from West End Central. A young East Asian in glasses with digital geek written all over him, and a much older man, about 60, with soft white hair, who couldn't possibly have been part of the Met because he was wearing a suit but no tie. Now they stirred.
Swire nodded curtly at Mallory and told him, "You will remain as SIO for the time being, but I'll be sitting in at the morning briefings and you will be reporting directly to me."
Gain and Whitestone exchanged a look. Mallory's time was passing. He was still senior investigating officer, but this no longer felt like his investigation. Operation Fatboy now felt like it was being run from Broadway, SW1, New Scotland Yard, not 27 Savile Row. Mallory was a good man, but the world was beating him down. Suddenly, his authority felt like a fragile thing that could be taken away by one gesture from the woman at the top of the conference table. I saw that Gain and Whitestone could not look at him. Swire gestured to the digital geek on her left. "This is Colin Chu of the Police Central E-Crime Unit. As you know, the PCEU is jointly funded by the Home Office and the Met to provide a national response to the most serious incidents of cybercrime. Bob the Butcher comes under their remit. Hopefully we might be able to show you a few new tricks," Chu said to Gain, his accent somewhere between Hong Kong and London. Gain said nothing. "I want Bob flushed out," Swire said. "I want him dragged out from behind his firewall. I want him taken seriously. We're becoming a laughingstock." She nodded sharply at me. Her hair did not move. "Especially after DC Wolf's recent stroll in the country." "We have taken Bob seriously, ma'am," Mallory insisted. She did not slap the table. She did not need to. She fixed Mallory with a look cold enough to give a snowman hypothermia. "Not seriously enough," she said. "The MP for Hillingdon North is highly thought of in Whitehall and Westminster." She inhaled deeply, exhaled slowly. "I am receiving phone calls." So that was it, I thought. The murders were too close to Ben King, and Swire had the full weight of Downing Street and Whitehall pressing on her back. She turned to the older man on her right. "And this is Dr. Joe Stephen of King's College London. Introduce yourself, Dr. Stephen."
"I'm a forensic psychologist, and I'm here to give assistance in any way I can," Dr. Stephen said. He had the smooth sing-song vowels of a Californian who had lived in London for 20 years. The Hollywood Hills meets Muswell Hill.
"What can you tell us so far?" Swire asked.
"Well," he said, "forensic psychology is more art than science. All I can do is look at the evidence and estimate what kind of individual would commit these crimes." There was a file before him, and he glanced down at it without, I sensed, really needing to. "To apprehend the the unknown subject, you need to understand that he is reordering the world. When women kill, they almost always kill someone they know. When men kill more than once, it's almost always strangers. Serial killers are invariably male." Gain folded his arms. "So we're looking for a man," he said. He smirked at Whitestone, but she wouldn't return his look or his smile. "That narrows it down," he muttered. Dr. Stephen stared at him. "A white man," he added. "And why is that?" said the black DI.
"Because the dead men are all white," Dr. Stephen said, "and serial killers almost always kill within their own race. That's not universal, but close enough to be considered a given."
He looked a little rattled. He had come in wanting to be our friend, and he was being forced to defend himself.
"What kind of white man, Dr. Stephen?"
Whitestone said, far friendlier than Gain.
"Any guess as to age, motive, social group?"
"A white man who is trying to right some perceived wrong," Dr. Stephen said. "A man who is punishing his victims. These are all planned attacks, very carefully planned attacks. These are not confrontational homicides. These are revenge homicides. The unsub is trying to right a wrong by the only means at his disposal, extreme violence. He is the product of a place
where violence is the means of achieving your aims. The resentment was coming off Gain like steam, but to me, Dr. Stephen was making sense. I thought of the terrible neatness of those carotid thrusts and the ease with which they opened arteries that could never be closed again. It was the work of a man who was remaking the world. "Maybe he's just a nutter," Gain said. Dr. Stephen smiled at him with a kind of embarrassed pity. "Then he is a nutter, your term, detective, not mine, who is restoring control over what he perceives to be a mad world. Honor, power, control. That's what matters to him. And when you find him, as you no doubt will, you will find a man who needs to control other men. A man who needs that more than anything in the world." "So you don't really know anything about him at all," Gain persisted. "Look, the reason I'm in this room is because these are stranger killings," Dr. Stephen said. "Most of the homicides you attend, the killer and the victim, are known to each other. The husband who murders his wife because of her infidelity, the mother who murders her child, the drug dealer who murders his business associate." He paused. "That link does not exist with a serial killer. He is not known to the victim. He is not a husband, a business associate, a friend. But the unknown sub leaves evidence. Psychiatric evidence. Behavioral evidence. Ritualistic evidence. The remnants of fantasy and madness." On the other side of the glass walls, I saw Scarlet Bush being escorted to the conference room. "Ah, this is Ms. Bush," Swire said when she entered the room, "who some of you will know already as crime correspondent for the Daily Post." The reporter circled the table, shaking hands and making smiling eye contact with everyone, including me. She played it as if we had never met. Then she took her place at the top of the conference table, next to Dr. Stephen. "This is the plan," Swire said. The shock of these words jolted Mallory upright and made the pain at the base of my spine pulse with alarm. Whitestone and Gain exchanged a startled look. "What plan?"
"Dr. Stephen is going to provide a detailed profile of Bob the Butcher," the chief super continued. "Then, based on this profile, Ms. Bush is going to write a comment piece in the Post designed to tempt Bob into explaining himself in an online interview. And Mr. Chu will be waiting to drive a very large hole through his firewall."
"Press his buttons," said Scarlet Bush. "Make Bob stop hiding behind the grandiose Robert Oppenheimer soundbites and raise his head above the parapet." Mallory shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"You really think he'll respond if you, what, insult him in print?"
"If I do it in the right way," Bush said. "Bob wouldn't be preening on a social network site if he wasn't vain, and if he didn't want attention, and if he wasn't a narcissist, and if he didn't want to justify himself to the world. Not necessarily insults. We have agreed that Dr. Stephen will have copy approval. More observations. Just enough that Bob will feel the need to explain himself. Just a little, just enough."
A look of disbelief must have passed across my face. Bush stared at me, not smiling now.
"He'll talk to me for the same reason that in the end they all talk to me," she continued. "Not because it would be great to hear his side of the story, but because I'm going to tell his story anyway. So he can either have his say or stay quiet and let the world have its say."
"That's the way it works, is it?" I said.
"That's exactly the way it works, detective." I turned to Swire. "Mom, we're throwing everything we've got at this Bob the Butcher, and...
and that's what we're going to keep throwing until we bury him,"
the chief super responded, cutting me off.
She turned to Chu.
"Colin, I'm confident that PCEU have the kit to find cracks in whatever encryption system, anonymizers and onion routers he's using."
Swire's eyes swept across the subdued MIT from West End Central.
"And then you're going to bring me his head on a spike," she told us.
Mallory was staring bleakly at his SIO policy book. The strength seemed to be visibly draining from him. The chief super had made it sound easy, so it felt like a betrayal when I looked out over St. James's Park and thought,
Why shouldn't it work? Trace, interview, eliminate. The TIE process was standard police procedure in any major investigation. Maybe Swire's plan was for the best. Flush the preening little bastard out from under his digital rock. Scarlet Bush leaned back in her chair. So, Dr. Stephen, what kind of guy is Bob the Butcher? She said.
I can tell you about the unsub, the American said. I can, I believe, also tell you something about Bob the Butcher. What I can't tell you is that they are one and the same.
Swire and Bush glanced at each other, and I saw just how desperately they both wanted Bob to be the same man. Our killer.
Society struggles to understand the repeat serious offender, Dr. Stephen continued, the serial rapist and the serial killer. Often they are the same thing, but at different stages on the road to madness.
But there's no sexual element to Bob's crimes, Swire said.
My point is that the serial rapist and the serial killer tend to share the same basic characteristics. Because transgression is a way of life, they tend to be charming, manipulative, vain, ruthless, morally numb, and devoid of even a shred of human empathy. The unsub will have a rich fantasy life, a fantasy life so rewarding that it will have come to have more substance than the real world. The unsub is likely to be a liar of near genius. As you know, serial killers often sail through lie detector tests. Trauma in his background is a given. Frequently, but not always, they come from backgrounds of mental and sexual abuse.
Scarlet Bush perked up.
You think Bob the Butcher was the victim of child abuse?
It's possible. The rational mind struggles to understand the psychopathology of the irrational. These murders are an expression of the killer's masculinity. As I said, these homicides are displays of honor, power, and control. Their sole purpose is punishment, for some perceived wrong done against the killer himself or a third party. The killer almost certainly doesn't know his victims. He is simply righting a wrong or a series of wrongs.
Scarlet Bush was jotting down notes. So you're saying that Bob the Butcher has a fragile masculinity, she said.
Not necessarily. But the unsub has a limited means of expressing his masculinity. He can't do it, for example, in the business world, so he does it with violence. He does it with murder.
What if we, implied that there was, for example, a gay element to the crimes?
Dr. Stephen looked at her levelly. I doubt you will endear yourself to him. Look, he's seeking to gain control of a situation that is totally beyond his control. Unlike the overwhelming majority of murderers, he fully intends his victims to die. What's unusual is that most homicides, as you know far better than me, are simply a byproduct of extreme violence. Most murder victims are just unlucky.
I'll say, said Gain.
Dr. Stephen had become good at ignoring him.
Medical help is delayed, he continued. A vital organ is accidentally severed. A fatal injury is sustained when a head hits the pavement.
A sharp point of pain in my neck began to throb.
Please.
The cut beneath the scab, where I had felt his knife.
Please.
I slowed my breathing before it was out of control.
Please. I have a daughter.
Our unsub sets out with the intention to kill, said Dr. Stephen. Honor, power, control. If I can tell you anything at all, it is that. Honor, power, control. There is your motive. These murders are an expression of affronted masculinity.
Bob and the killer no longer sounded to me like people who were just different. They sounded like polar opposites.
Dr. Stephen smiled pleasantly. And I can tell you one more thing for nothing, he said.
We all looked at him.
He won't stop.
Chapter 21 The Fox
had the playing fields to himself. I'd driven out to Potter's Field for Guy Phillips' memorial service, and with an hour to kill, I had wandered out to the playing fields, remembering when Piggy had come running from the woods with the life draining out of him. The rugby and football pitches were all empty now. It was just the lone fox, which I'd watched come out of the trees and mooch along the touchline of the far rugby field, heading towards the little stone cottage. There was no sign of Len Zukov, the groundsman, but the fox moved more warily near this sign of civilization, slowing his pace and raising his head to sniff the air. My phone began to vibrate as I saw the fox veer away from the cottage and move into the great muddy green expanse of the playing fields. Wren was calling. She wasn't in MIR1. I could hear street noises, voices I didn't know.
"Edward Duncan," she said.
"Yes?"
"He doesn't have a criminal record. He doesn't have a driving license. He doesn't have a national insurance number. He doesn't have a passport, and he doesn't have a credit card, a bank account, or a wife."
She was pleased with herself. I could almost see her grinning with pleasure, brushing a strand of red hair from her pale face. "What does he have?" I said.
"Edward Duncan has an art dealer."
I let it sink in. "Well done, Wren."
"Neris Fine Art. Small place, North London, right at the top of Heath Street, Hampstead Way. I drove past it."
"I didn't ask you to do that, did I?"
"Relax, detective. I didn't go in. It was closed anyway. It's tiny."
"Neris Fine Art," I said.
"It's a Greek myth," Wren explained. "Neris was a god of the sea. He was kind and just, and he had a special power."
"Go on."
"He had the power to change his shape."
The fox was trotting towards me, taking his time. "Thank you," I said.
"See? Everyone leaves a shadow."
I took down the details of Nero's fine art.
"When are you going to check it out?" she said.
"When I get back to town," I said. "Tonight."
"Pick me up at West End Central."
"Why would I do that?"
"Because I'm coming with you."
I almost laughed. "You're not coming with me. This is off the book."
"And that's exactly why I'm coming with you," she said. "It's off the book, and I found him, and I'm coming with you."
I figured we could argue about it later.
"Who is he?" she said. "Who's Edward Duncan?"
The fox had paused in the centre circle of the football pitch. He sniffed the air, then pointed his face at the dirt and began to dig furiously. "Edward Duncan is a dead man," I said. It was a shock to see Captain Ned King again. He wore the immaculate black dress uniform of an officer in the Royal Gurkha Rifles, but he was unshaven and red-eyed, as if he had come to the Potter's Field College Chapel straight from Bryce Norton, as if he had spent last night on a Hercules transport plane. But what shocked me was how alike Ned King was to his brother, yet how totally different. They sat side by side in the ancient chapel, as Peregrine War glared out from the lectern. Ben King, with his smooth politician's face, Captain King with his scarred soldier's face, although I remembered it wasn't soldiering that had scarred his face. Salman Khan was by Ben King's side, and he was looking up at the stupendously tall headmaster as if he might be asked questions later. "We gather today to remember Mr. Phillips," War said. "An old boy. A master. A friend." Like most good public speakers, War was a bit of a ham. He told us to look at the memorial leaflet. He told us to look at the year when Guy Phillips was born and the year when he died. And he said that they were not important, that what mattered most was what came between them. What mattered most was the dash. His life. He talked about Phillips as if he had been a cross between Mother Teresa and Jesus Christ. I thought of poor dead Piggy. I saw him hurting Natasha at Hugo Buck's funeral. I saw him making his pupils roll in the mud. It seemed to me that he had spent the dash bullying. But War was a commanding speaker, and I could hear the wet noses and choked throats of emotion behind me.
Yet as I looked at the headmaster's stone-hard face, I could not decide if Guy Phillips had meant everything to Peregrine War, or nothing at all. The Potter's Field College Chapel was packed with what felt like the entire school. Black-robed masters in the first few rows, a great mass of boys in green and purple behind them, and, under the stained-glass window, six rows of the choir facing another six rows. More boys and masters lined the perimeter of the chapel and spilled through the open doorways. The place was much smaller than I had expected. I had read online that building work had been interrupted during the War of the Roses and had yet to resume. And I had the feeling I always got at Potter's Field, that you could blink your eye and 100 years would go by. Captain King walked to the lectern. "Our revels now are ended," he read. "These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and, like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind." Salman Khan hung his head and wept. Ben King kept his eyes on the shattered face of his brother as Captain King's words filled the ancient chapel. "We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep." Captain King's delivery was matter of fact, yet the words carried real meaning. He was composed and yet replete with emotion. He was good at that, but then he had had a lot of practice. Captain King returned to the front row, touching Khan once on the shoulder before taking his place next to his brother. Their wives sat behind them, pretty women, sleek and sexy even in their mourning clothes, shepherding well-behaved children with braces on their teeth. The ladies' fat jewels glistened. There was plenty of money and time for their children's bodies, minds, and orthodontics. The King brothers and Khan all had families, and I guessed that they loved those families. But the real bonds, the unbreakable bonds, the bonds of a lifetime, they were different, because they were with each other. After the memorial service, I walked across the playing fields, skirting the rugby pitches, where a games lesson was taking place. The boys all wore black armbands for their murdered sportsmaster. The sounds of flesh crashing into flesh, stud onto bone, cries and laughter faded behind me as I headed towards the stone cottage where Len Zukov lived. I knocked on the door. There was no answer. I walked round the back of the cottage, turning up my collar against the bitter wind. I stopped when I saw the fox. It lay on top of the compost heap, a ragged sack of fur and bone waiting for the fire. Its neck had been neatly broken. I got back to town at 5 in the afternoon. The November day already as dark as midnight, and London's 180-minute rush hour starting to get mad. I sent Ren a text when I was on Piccadilly, and she was waiting for me outside 27 Savile Row when I arrived. She got into the X5 with a triumphant smile. "If it wasn't for me," she said, "you'd still be dicking about on Google." "I'd go through Regent's Park if I were you. The traffic is always surprisingly light around the park." I took the park route, and within 15 minutes we were on the Finchley Road. The traffic, heavy, but moving steadily. And then it was thinning, and the road was rising steeply towards the end of Heath Street as we climbed to the highest point of the city. I realised that we were close to the meadow where Scout and I had let Stan off his lead and lost him. I had never noticed all the art galleries before. You drive out of Hampstead, and they are the last thing you see, a cluster of them, all shapes and sizes, just before you were surrounded by the wild green expanse of the heath. As the car crawled higher, I saw that some of these galleries were high-end, great lavish spaces with large expensively lit canvases displayed in the window. Other places were far more modest, local artists selling their work to a local clientele.
The one we were looking for was little more than a darkened hole in the wall.
This is it, Ren said.
Nereus, fine art. I slowed as we drove past and caught a glimpse of a tiny space behind wrought iron railings, glinting under the streetlights. A recycling bin was overturned, its contents spilled over the narrow pavement. Ren was already unclipping her seatbelt as I crested the hill. I found a parking space behind Jack Straw's castle. But when we walked back to the gallery, we found that Nehru's fine art was closed. Two small landscapes were displayed in the window. A wave of junk mail was washed up inside the glass door. Back soon, lied a sign. I stood back. It was a three-story building. The small gallery had a basement flat below and a flat above. I leaned over the wrought iron railings, looking down and then up. Both of the flats were in darkness. Broken glass crunched beneath my feet, and the recycling bin looked as though it had been rifled through by a fox that had come down from the heath. He had been out of luck. It was just beer bottles and empty pizza boxes. I looked up and down the street. We were on the edge of Hampstead affluence. Businesses were either booming or going bust. Apart from the galleries, there were a few restaurants and clothes stores, but over half of them had closed down. The buildings all had exactly the same wrought iron railings as Nehru's. The blue and red lights of burglar alarms blinked on even the most modest buildings. Let's go, I said. I've got another call to make. Where should I drop you?
I'll come with you.
I looked at her. How old was she? 25? Younger? Don't you have a life to go to? I said.
I can't see my boyfriend tonight. A beat. He has to have dinner with his wife.
Another beat.
It's her birthday.
She towed the broken beer bottles, then pushed aside an empty pizza box with fossilized cheese on its side.
A man lives here, she said.
How do you know it's a man?
Only men live like this. Men and pigs.
Holloway was a few miles and several light years away from Hampstead. Ren and I stood before a large dusty shop window where pride of place was given to a showroom dummy dressed as a German soldier from World War II.
How did you know about this place? Ren said.
I dicked about on Google, I said. Under its coal scuttle helmet, the mannequin had the gently pouting features of a young male model. But the clothes he wore were heavy and harsh and made for invading Russia. A thick wool greatcoat was draped over a rough tunic, both far too large for the delicate, snake-hipped dummy, and baggy trousers were tucked into leather boots. It all looked impossibly old and fragile, as if it would disintegrate with one touch. Is any of this stuff real? I wondered.
Those boots aren't, Ren said. Everything else might be, but the boots never.
The Krauts wore their boots out. On the Eastern Front, the Germans used to saw the legs off dead Russian soldiers and defrost them in some lucky peasant's oven just to get at the boots. I stared at her.
My dad, she said, he liked World War II. Is that the expression? Liking it? He was interested, let's say.
The World at War, boxed set, and all that. The rest of the window was full of lovingly presented junk. Buttons, posters, faded scraps of metal and cloth and card and leather, all of it displayed like holy relics. Second Front, it said above the store. Collectible Militaria. The lights were going out inside. A cop knocked on the door. A long-haired man, not young, stuck his head around the door.
I'm just closing up, he said.
Don't let us stop you.